Hello, welcome to PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight from the US President.
America is again winning each and every day. The state of our union is strong.
Lots to celebrate, says Donald Trump in his delayed State of the Union address, but there's a swipe for the Mueller investigation too.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations.
So what to make, then, of the president's calls for unity in Washington? The president also confirms he'll meet again with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Analysis ahead and much more. This is PM. First tonight, the Reserve Bank governor staged a massive about-face on interest rates during a lunchtime speech to journalists today. From a consistent position for the past year or more that the next move in rates would likely be up, Philip Lowe now says rates could go either way next time, up or down. The RBA's change of heart comes amid uncertainty after a steady stream of disappointing economic data over the past few months and the continued steep decline in Sydney and Melbourne home prices. Our business reporter Michael Yander was at Dr. Lowe's speech today. Michael, just how significant is this change of tack on rates from the Reserve Bank boss?
Well, to put it simply, it took basically a cent off the Australian dollar in a matter of minutes. Markets had been factoring in gradually the chance that the Reserve Bank might have to shift to a stance of possible rate cuts, but they hadn't necessarily expected it to happen so quickly or in today's speech. And it's now an official stance, basically a neutral policy, where the Reserve Bank could go either way. For a year or more, the Reserve Bank has maintained the official line, even at its meeting yesterday, that the next move in interest rates was probably likely to be up. But we've firmly moved away from that now. The probabilities, according to Dr. Lowe, appear to be evenly balanced. And when pressed, Dr. Lowe didn't want to put exact odds on the chances of a rate cut.
Is it a coin toss? I would never describe it that way because that gives the sense that it's kind of like completely random. There are two scenarios, basically, and they seem roughly equally likely to me. Whether it's 50-50 or 55-45, I don't want to comment on that because our crystal ball isn't clear enough to know that.
That was Philip Lowe speaking at the National Press Club in Sydney. This about-face is due to a raft of downbeat economic data. September quarter GDP, the economic growth figures, were the main ones, coming in at 0.3% and 2.8% for the year, much below economist expectations and the Reserve Bank's forecasts. The Reserve Bank has now had to lower those forecasts, as Dr. Lowe also revealed today, by a quarter of a percentage point. Economists expect further downgrades to those forecasts to come.
So what are the main risks to the Australian economy that have prompted this change of heart by the Reserve Bank boss?
There's basically two groups. One is overseas risks, Donald Trump being one of those and his trade war with China, and then the Chinese domestic economy being the other one of those major overseas risks, with quite a significant slowdown there and a crackdown on lending that is taking steam out of our main export destination. Domestically, it's all about housing, house price falls in Sydney and Melbourne in particular, and the effect on household consumption that may have. A lot of the economic commentary has been centred on this impact of falling house prices on the broader economy, but Dr. Lowe said the RBA is actually much more concerned about the risks coming from China's economic slowdown.
If we're to have a significant downturn in the economy, I think the catalyst would be something going wrong in the global economy. So that would be number one, and China would be at the top of that list. If the Chinese economy stumbled, the authorities didn't manage the tightening up in credit world and the Chinese economy slowed, I think that would hurt us a lot. Of the domestic sources of risk, the housing market, consumption nexus is the most prominent one. But I wouldn't say that's more prominent than the overseas risks.
Philip Lowe, the RBA governor. So, Michael, the governor really talked about two possible scenarios for the Australian economy, a good one where rates rise and one where rates are cut. Can you explain what those scenarios look like?
So in the Reserve Bank's optimal scenario, jobs growth continues and there are indications, as Dr. Lowe said in answering questions, that job vacancies are at record highs. Unemployment in New South Wales and Victoria is multi-decade lows. Those tight job markets cause wages to keep rising. There's signs that has started and the RBA hopes that will continue, and those wage rises will offset the negative wealth effects and confidence effects from house price falls, so we'll keep spending. Now, the negative scenario is that construction jobs go, outweighing the increase in jobs in any other sector, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. As unemployment rises because of those unemployed construction workers, wage increases suddenly dry up, and then we've got the worst of both worlds: falling house prices, rising unemployment and stagnant wages.
Well, a 50-50 bet. Thanks very much, Michael. The ABC's senior digital business reporter is Michael Yander. Well, a Chinese billionaire who has donated large sums of money to the major political parties through his companies has been denied re-entry to Australia. His name is Huang Zhengmo, the same businessman whose ties to Sam Dastyari led to the former Labor senator's political downfall. Now the ABC has confirmed that Mr. Huang has been prevented by the government from returning to Australia. To quote the ABC's sources, Mr. Huang's right to return to Australia has been cancelled. Our political reporter Alexandra Beach joins me. Alex, what has led Australian officials to block Huang Zhengmo from coming back to Australia?
Linda, the ABC understands that Australian officials aren't allowing him back into Australia. He's been stripped of permanent residency and denied Australian citizenship. And this all relates back to the federal government's crackdown on alleged foreign interference. That's Australian intelligence agencies have for some time been raising concerns that the Chinese Communist Party could be interfering in Australian institutions and using the political donation system to gain access. Several years ago, spy agency ASIO, for example, warned the major political parties about taking donations from Mr. Huang's companies because its intelligence revealed close links to the Chinese Communist Party. So Mr. Huang has previously denied that connection or any attempt to influence Australian politics. And the ABC has put questions to his lawyer about this decision from the Home Affairs Department, but we haven't received a response on whether he's going to appeal or challenge this.
Is it a permanent decision? Might Huang Zhengmo be able to return to Australia in future?
Well, Nine is reporting that he is fighting this decision and that he has family still here in Australia. He had previously applied for Australian citizenship, but that's been hanging in limbo. You might recall that Sam Dastyari, as you mentioned, tried to help Mr. Huang with that citizenship application by contacting the Immigration Department. The ABC understands that now that application's been rejected, and Nine's reported that there's several reasons for that, such as character grounds and also concerns about the reliability of Mr. Huang's answers in interviews. The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, was also asked whether she expected China to raise this whole matter with her. This was her response.
They have not been raised with me. I don't expect it to be a subject of a bilateral discussion. These are matters which occur from time to time.
Matters which occur from time to time, the Foreign Minister Maurice Payne. So, Alex, Huang Zhengmo, through his companies, has donated millions of dollars to the major political parties, both sides. Any indication as to whether they will return that money now that a further cloud is hanging over his reputation?
Well, previously, some politicians from both sides of the political divide have handed back money donated to them through his companies. So the Prime Minister Scott Morrison and Labor leader Bill Shorten were both asked today whether their respective parties would now do that. Here's what they had to say.
I'm not in a position to say what the position was, you know, several years ago. So where these things have happened in good faith, and, you know, we know that the donations have been made to many political parties, not just one, then we have prospective laws that deal with that into the future, and I think that's the responsible way to deal with it.
Well, we stopped taking money from him a couple of years ago. In fact, Labor stopped taking donations from that gentleman and another person before the law caught up with our position. So for a number of years, we haven't dealt with this man.
That's Bill Shorten and before him the Prime Minister. Now, there neither has actually committed to paying back donations previously made. They both refer to laws Federal Parliament passed last year to ban future foreign donations, but it is worth noting that the donations linked to Mr. Huang were made through Australian companies, so even with those new laws, they'd still be allowed.
Okay, thanks very much, Alex. Alexandra Beach, our political reporter in Canberra. You're listening to PM. Ahead, a big development in the scandal in Victoria where lawyers became police informants. The Royal Commissioner quits as it's revealed that a gangland lawyer registered as an informant a decade earlier than previously known. Experts are shocked by this revelation.
Well, this just goes to the heart of policing and criminal justice in Victoria over the period of the last 25 years or thereabouts. It's no less serious than that.
Well, the US President Donald Trump has used his annual State of the Union address to call for unity and more cooperation in American politics. The speech, which had been delayed by the record partial government shutdown, touched on a range of policy goals, but a significant chunk of it was, as expected, again focused on curbing illegal immigration and the president's very controversial pet project, a border wall with Mexico. North America correspondent James Glenday reports from Washington.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
Donald Trump has long sold himself as a skilled negotiator, someone who can do deals. And he clearly wanted this speech to Congress and the millions of Americans watching at home to be remembered as a call for bipartisanship.
We meet tonight at a moment of unlimited potential. I stand here ready to work with you to achieve historic breakthroughs for all Americans.
That sort of statement could have come from any of his predecessors. Even though this president is often unpredictable, his State of the Union address was in many ways quite conventional. He put out a list of policy aims, some ambitious, like reducing the cost of medication, some bipartisan, like his call to improve infrastructure, and others highly unlikely to go far. His request for laws to restrict late-term abortion probably falls into that category. But the overarching message of the whole event was, let's avoid legislative gridlock.
We can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds, build new coalitions, forge new solutions, and unlock the extraordinary promise of America's future.
Of course, that sort of language does gloss over the deeply divisive political climate in America, a climate that Donald Trump has undoubtedly helped create. He now needs the Democrats to get things done. They hold the House and have the power to set up investigations into his affairs, something the president pleaded with them to avoid.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
The message of cooperation was always going to be a hard sell, particularly to his political opponents, considering the events of the past few months. The record 35-day-long government shutdown is resolved, at least for now, but the issue that sparked it, a presidential demand for billions in border wall funding, is not. Neither side is budging. Donald Trump spent a considerable chunk of time in his speech making his case yet again for his pet project, but he didn't say whether there would be another shutdown or if he'd declare a national emergency to go around Congress to get the money.
Congress has 10 days left to pass a bill that will fund our government, protect our homeland, and secure our very dangerous southern border. Now is the time for Congress to show the world that America is committed to ending illegal immigration and putting the ruthless coyotes, cartels, drug dealers, and human traffickers out of business.
Those cheers you hear came from the Republicans only. The Democrats sat relatively silently. A few even shook their heads. It was left to Stacey Abrams, a failed gubernatorial candidate, to condemn the wall and the shutdown during the party's formal State of the Union response.
Making livelihoods of our federal workers a pawn for political games is a disgrace. The shutdown was a stunt engineered by the President of the United States, one that defied every tenet of fairness and abandoned not just our people, but our values.
In total, Donald Trump's speech ran for 1 hour and 22 minutes, making it the third longest on record, and it did contain some other interesting snippets of information. The president doubled down on his troop withdrawals from Syria and Afghanistan. He spoke about the trade talks with China, criticised Iran, and even claimed the US would be in a major war with North Korea if he hadn't been elected, an assertion that was met with some boos. Many women in Congress, including the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, chose to wear white for the occasion. And Donald Trump did achieve his aim of unifying the House, at least briefly, when he paused to praise them.
One century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
In Washington, this is James Glenday reporting for PM.
Well, let's look at a few more elements of that speech. Professor Gordon Flake is the founding CEO of the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia. He joins me. Gordon, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
A strong appeal for bipartisanship, but a return to many of the same messages on divisive issues like the border wall. Will this end the gridlock on the wall or anything else for that matter?
No, it's difficult to see anything changing. Not surprising, I think, that there was a call for bipartisanship. And in some ways, that was probably just a strategy to neutralize the Democratic response beforehand. In the end, it was a lot of the same themes we've heard in recent speeches.
On the other hand, the president made the call to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the US within 10 years. He spoke of the need to do something about hugely inflated costs of drugs in America, the need to act on the opioid epidemic. Aren't these potentially bipartisan issues?
They certainly are, but they all kind of fall in the normal laundry list of such issues that are thrown out without a plan or without prioritization. In some respects, you know, the issue where there was the greatest expectation of bipartisan cooperation 2 years ago was on infrastructure. And now that's become a running joke. The notion is that every week is infrastructure week, and yet somehow it never becomes prioritized. And it certainly wasn't prioritized this speech as well when the focus was on the president's pet project, the wall, which is obviously a different type of infrastructure. But again, there's a lot out there, like any speech. Again, a long laundry list. What there wasn't was a plan, any indication of priority or primacy of place in the speech itself or in the president's own mind.
James Glenday, our reporter, just mentioned the sea of Democrat, mostly Democrat women wearing white, that suffragette symbolism, and the president celebrating the numbers of women in Congress, even though they mostly got there as opponents to him. But then he made this remark on abortion.
And then we had the case of the governor of Virginia, where he stated he would execute a baby after birth. To defend the dignity of every person, I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in the mother's womb.
Now, abortion obviously always a lightning rod issue in the US, but Gordon Flake, what was that moment about in particular?
Well, this is a bit of a strange development in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I'm not entirely sure of what the impetus was. Both New York and Virginia passed laws had movements towards passing laws that would lift some restrictions on late-term abortions, particularly in the case where the health of the mother was jeopardized and when the fetus was not viable outside the womb. But those types of nuances were completely lost in the debate. So all of a sudden in social media, in my own social media feed, you began to see this massive flow of information, you know, that suggested precisely as the president did in his speech that all of a sudden that Democrats were preparing to kill babies that were, you know, just about to be born, which is exactly not what the issue is about. But clearly there was an effort to kind of whip this issue up once again. Unfortunately for the governor of Virginia, obviously he has much bigger issues than that issue in the speech when there's questions of his own past and racism that is more to the forefront. But it's probably what you would call a below-the-belt hit, something to kind of give red meat to the partisan base that he's had on this issue in particular.
A lot of ground was covered by the president internationally. Again, James Glenday mentioned a bit of that. But a big announcement was a confirmed second summit with Kim Jong-un of North Korea on the 27th and 28th of February in Vietnam, accompanied by this claim.
Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped. And there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected President of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
So, Gordon Flake, perhaps an observation on that, but also on the prospects for the summit, given that last week the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coates, said it's unlikely North Korea will try to denuclearize.
Well, obviously the important qualifier there is his phrase, in my opinion. I've been working on North Korea for well over 30 years now. And on the one hand, well, I'll be the first to say that jaw-jaw is better than war-war, to use the old Churchillian phrase. And I'm certainly happy that we're not on the cusp of conflict that we were just a year ago, right, prior to the Winter Olympics in South Korea. In some respects, you know, I'm loath to give too much credit to the Trump administration for this, because one of the reasons we were at the brink of war, if you recall, it was in late 2017, the little rocket man's, you know, comments and the threats of fire and fury such as the world has never known. So don't tend to give somebody an award for putting out a fire that he started. You know, there was a high level of tension because of the Trump administration. I'm glad that we've walked away from tension now. But unfortunately, by almost every account, the Singapore summit did not accomplish what it was intended to. It represented a significant step back on every one of the major points in the agreement itself from where we had been previously, and also did some serious damage to international nonproliferation efforts, efforts to denuclearize North Korea, and alliance coordination. And so in the end, obviously, there's hope that the second summit in Hanoi at the end of this month will be able to avoid the pitfalls of the first. But again, I think scant hope in that.
Okay. Thanks very much for your time, Professor Gordon Flake from the US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. You can reach me on Twitter at Linda Mottram. Stay with me. We're going to explore some man-made wetlands in Sydney's west, now at risk of being bulldozed to make way for development.
We have no idea at this stage. It could be gazetted in 5 minutes, 5 weeks, year and a half. 10 of those birds that come here are actually protected under federal government agreement with those countries.
A scandal in Victoria which could see dozens of criminals released from jail took a new twist today. It's emerged that the defence barrister at the centre of the storm was registered as a police informant a decade before Victoria Police previously admitted. Other lawyers had also been registered as informers for police, although the Attorney-General Jill Hennessy wouldn't say how many. The revelations prompted Malcolm Hyde, the commissioner investigating the scandal, to resign and could bring many more criminal convictions into question. Eleanor Whitehead has the story.
Victorian Attorney General Jill Hennessy dropped a bombshell this morning.
The commission has been notified and advised by Victoria Police that the informant that is at the centre of this Royal Commission was in fact a registered informant, not initially in 2005, but in 1995.
She was talking about Lawyer X, the criminal barrister who defended some of Victoria's most notorious mobsters during Melbourne's bloody gang wars. At the same time, she was acting as an informant for police. Her case prompted Premier Dan Andrews to call a royal commission into the use of informants, but it now seems Lawyer X was not alone.
There have also been a number of other informants that have been identified and willingly disclosed. I'm not in a position to identify how many.
Police said the error was due to poor record keeping. The news prompted Commissioner Malcolm Hyde to resign because he had worked for Victoria Police while Lawyer X was registered as an informant.
Commissioner Hyde has come to the view that these additional disclosures and this new information in respect of the informant at the centre of this matter could generate a perception that he is not exercising his powers impartially. I do wish to emphasise that Commissioner Hyde had no knowledge or involvement in this matter.
Last year, the Department of Public Prosecutions wrote to 20 convicted criminals who could try to have their sentences quashed because the lawyer was working with police. Many more convictions may now be in jeopardy. Colleen Lewis is Adjunct Professor of Criminology at Monash University.
This can have enormous implications for appeals to people who are currently serving time in prison and their ability also to then sue the government. And it also has the potential to actually undermine trust in Victoria's criminal justice system. And it's going to take a long time. and a lot of taxpayers' money, I add, to try and put this right.
Victoria Police spent $4.5 million in legal costs trying to keep their arrangements a secret due to fears their informant was in danger. Last year, the High Court described the police's conduct as reprehensible and said Lawyer X had engaged in a fundamental and appalling breach of her obligations as a barrister. Attorney General Jill Hennessy says the terms of the Royal Commission will now be extended, allowing it to expand its investigation of informants. But Darren Palmer, Associate Professor of Criminology at Deakin University, says the revelations raise wider concerns.
Well, this just goes to the heart of policing and criminal justice in Victoria over the period of the last 25 years or thereabouts. It's no less serious than that. There's something much deeper and richer to understand here over a much longer period back to the 1990s.
He's calling for a much deeper inquiry.
This is not just about informers. It's also about police attitudes, police cultural attitudes, police practices, and the administration of justice in full. This is going to have to be a much larger Royal Commission than has been proposed so far.
Associate Professor Darren Palmer from Deakin University. Eleanor Whitehead, our reporter. Small sanctuaries in the urban landscape can be a lifeline for wildlife, experts tell us. But they're frequently under pressure, and that is the situation for a small wetland that has become a sanctuary for migratory birds and an endangered frog in Western Sydney. The 10-square-hectare space has been earmarked for a development known as the Marsden Park North Master Plan by the New South Wales government, which is just weeks away from an election. The government says the wetlands are contaminated and have promised to build an alternative, but locals are fighting to save what's already there, saying the government's plan isn't enough. Sarah Maunder reports.
Time is running out for locals to save this small patch of land about 60 kilometres west of Sydney. Maureen Harper is part of the Cumberland Conservation Network, the group behind the rescue campaign.
We're just walking down a little lane which leads towards the Riverstone Wetlands. It's the end of Park Road in Marsden Park, and it is a most amazing example of the Cumberland Plain woodland vegetation.
The wetlands were originally built as evaporation ponds for the Riverstone Meatworks, but when the abattoir closed in the 1980s, the shallow ponds became a habitat for birds and the endangered green and golden bell frog. The Cumberland Conservation Network says the Riverstone Wetlands is one of the last areas where the frog can be found in Western Sydney.
Migratory birds that do visit, and they come from as far away as Japan, China, Russia and New Zealand. 10 of those birds that come here are actually protected under federal government agreement with those countries' migratory agreements. Some of the important ones are the Pacific Golden Plover, Sharp-tailed Sandpiper, the Wood Sandpiper and Latham's Snipe.
But the ponds could soon disappear with plans to develop the site into an area known as the Marsden Park North Master Plan by the New South Wales government that includes housing, playing fields and a commercial site. The ponds are proposed to be bulldozed to make room for the development. In a statement, the Department of Planning and Environment says it commissioned an independent review into the wetlands that found keeping the ponds would have significant public health and safety issues for future residents. There's a risk the ponds could become contaminated. Mosquitoes that breed there can spread disease and water overflow due to pond wall failure or overtopping. The department says it has proposed to build a new habitat nearby to accommodate the wildlife before the current ponds are removed. It says plans for the area are still being finalised, but Maureen Harper says it's a nervous wait.
We have no idea at this stage. The draft master plan has been on display and the submissions finished prior to September, October last year. At this stage, as far as we understand, it could be gazetted in 5 minutes, 5 weeks, year and a half. So we are hoping that doesn't happen.
Mark Fuller is also with the Cumberland Conservation Network, a long-time Western Sydney resident and an avid bird watcher. He worries the wildlife won't use the new area.
I am sceptical, basically because nature, it's like if you found a place that's so good and so fantastic, there's no other place in Western Sydney like it, why would you then think that you'll be able to create somewhere just as good as that?
Mark Fuller says there's a lesson to be learned about future development in Western Sydney.
Instead of carrying on at this breakneck speed and losing things that we're not even aware of, if we can just stop and rest for a while and maybe look around and look at what we've got, and maybe change the mindset to appreciate the rarer Australian wildlife and do what we can to preserve it in our urban habitats.
Cumberland Conservation Network member Mark Fuller, Sarah Maunder with that report. And that's PM for tonight. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for your company. The program is in the usual places, the ABC Listen app, or search ABC PM. You'll find us on the web. All our stories are in both those places. And you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catch AM in the morning with Sabra Lane. Samantha Donovan will be along with The World Today at lunchtime. And I'm elsewhere tomorrow. But Caroline Winter will be here with PM, so do join her then. And I'm back on Friday. More great radio ahead now for you, though, and updates from ABC News throughout the evening. Have a good night.